Est-ce que c'est bon?
Ouais, c'est bon.
Bon, cette séance aujourd'hui ouvre le volet du thème du droit. Et donc c'est la première des trois conférences que nous aurons sur ce thème-là, sur la transnationalisation du droit et la circulation des normes légales ou juridiques à l'échelle internationale. Nous aurons aussi Ariane Morin, la semaine prochaine, qui nous parlera de la transnationalisation du droit suisse, et une table ronde aussi sur les processus de Bologne et donc l'imposition à l'échelle européenne aux universités de certaines normes, de cursus d'études, etc., de reconnaissance des diplômes.
Eva Hartmann, qui est présente là, qui est aussi dans notre conférence, qui n'est pas la seule.
Donc nous sommes ravis aujourd'hui d'accueillir Shalini Randeria, qui est ici, et qui est professeure à l'université de Zurich, mais qui a, comme tous les anthropologues qui travaillent sur la globalisation, qui a enseigné un peu dans le monde entier, qui a d'abord fait ses études en Inde, et qui ensuite est allé à Oxford, puis à Berlin, puis à Munich, puis à Budapest, puis à Bombay de nouveau, et de retour à Zurich. Et donc, c'est un parcours qui reflète un peu les exigences, disons, de l'anthropologie postcoloniale et sur la globalisation. Et il est aussi, notamment, membre du comité de rédaction du Journal of Global History, dont vous avez la référence sur le blog. Nous avons mis dans les petits signés les index sur la droite des pages. Alors, évidemment, elle a d'innombrables publications, parmi lesquelles il y a plusieurs coéditions qui méritent d'être mentionnées, notamment avec Andreas Eckert l'année passée, un livre dont le titre est « From Imperialismus zum Empire, Globalisierung aus postkolonialen Perspektiven ». Donc c'est de l'impérialisme à l'empire, la globalisation du point de vue postcolonial, ou deux points de vue au pluriel postcoloniaux. Elle a aussi coédité un livre en anglais cette fois, « Unraveling Ties from Social Cohesion to New Practices of Connectedness » en 2002. Et enfin, pour mentionner certains ouvrages plutôt que d'autres, un livre en allemand, cette fois coédité, « Globalisierung aus Frauensicht, Bilanzen und Visionen », donc la globalisation du point de vue des femmes, bilan et vision, en 2000. Elle est aussi l'auteur d'une soixantaine d'articles, parmi lesquels celui que nous vous invitions à lire pour aujourd'hui et qui s'appelait « The State of Globalization, Legal Plurality, Overlapping Sovereignties and Ambiguous Alliances between Civil Society and the Cunning State in India », paru dans « Theory, Culture and Society » en 2007. Et donc, dans cet article, pour faire le lien cette fois avec le séminaire, dans cet article, Shalini Randeria défend plusieurs points de vue. D'abord, un point de vue historique, c'est ça qui nous intéresse en partie ici, en rappelant qu'il faut tenir compte de l'histoire coloniale des différents pays, puisque le droit est en partie hérité de certaines structures coloniales. Elle défend aussi un point de vue sociologique, puisqu'elle s'interroge sur la régulation sociale, le rôle que l'État peut jouer dans la régulation sociale, pardon, et elle s'interroge aussi sur les lieux de production de ces normes sociales. Et on verra aujourd'hui que l'État n'a plus aujourd'hui la prérogative de cette production de normes à l'échelle nationale. Elle défend aussi un point de vue ethnographique, ça nous intéresse aussi particulièrement ici. C'est pas seulement une exigence méthodologique, dans le sens où il faut intégrer dans le questionnaire une ethnographie, des études de cas, etc. C'est aussi, comme elle le défend dans son papier, l'idée que la structure du pouvoir à l'échelle internationale a changé, et donc que c'est un pouvoir diffus, extrêmement contextualisé, qui peut faire l'objet de déni, et donc que pour le saisir dans ses mécanismes les plus infimes, il faut faire un travail de terrain extrêmement précis et contextualisé, et donc du coup, l'exigence ethnographique, c'est presque une nécessité épistémologique pour comprendre la reconfiguration du pouvoir actuel à l'échelle mondiale. Dans son papier, mais elle en reparlera tout à l'heure, elle place au centre de son interrogation la marge de manœuvre qu'ont les États dans le contexte de la reconfiguration du pouvoir à l'échelle internationale, disons pour son cas, à partir des années 1990. Donc d'une part, des changements de politique de la Banque mondiale, mais aussi dans l'État indien, une politique de rigueur budgétaire qui fait qu'il y a certaines décisions qui sont prises à l'échelle gouvernementale, qui sont justifiées par ces déficits, ces manques de fonds, etc. Et si vous avez lu le texte, vous avez peut-être été surpris par deux choses. La première, c'est que l'État indien n'exerce pas toujours tout le pouvoir dont il dispose pour défendre l'ensemble de ses citoyens. Voilà pourquoi Shalini Randeria parle de « cunning states », donc des États qui sont ils ont habiles, malins, etc. Et c'est des États qui jouent sur leur soi-disant manque de marge de manœuvre pour choisir en fait entre des politiques alternatives à l'intérieur même du pays. Elle appelle ça les « cunning states ». Et donc la première surprise, c'est que les États ne profitent pas toujours de tout le pouvoir dont ils pourraient avoir et que c'est aux ONG et à la société civile de rappeler les États à leurs obligations de représenter l'ensemble des citoyens et non pas seulement certains citoyens plus riches que d'autres ou certains secteurs plus liés à l'exportation que d'autres. La deuxième surprise, c'est que les ONG et la société civile, pour pouvoir rappeler en quelque sorte les États à leurs obligations, sont obligés de sauter des échelles. Ils doivent travailler à l'échelle locale en appelant par exemple aux droits coutumiers de certains groupes sociaux, disons aux droits coutumiers à la terre, au savoir ancestral, etc. Et ils doivent aussi aller dans les arènes multinationales, donc à l'ONU, etc., pour faire valoir ces droits, pour essayer de prendre en tenaille les États, enfin l'État indien en l'occurrence, pour le rappeler justement à ses obligations. Mais, et c'est la deuxième surprise de l'article, cette prise en tenaille, des fois, elle a des effets pervers, puisque elle suggère ou elle incite les États à changer de politique et à retirer de l'examen démocratique certaines politiques, notamment à interrompre des projets menés avec la Banque mondiale pour recourir à d'autres formes de fonds privés qui, eux, ne sont pas soumis justement à cet examen parlementaire des ONG, etc. Et donc c'est la deuxième surprise de ces cunning states. D'une part, ils n'exercent pas tout leur pouvoir et par ailleurs, des fois, ils essayent de mener des politiques à l'abri, en quelque sorte, du regard citoyen. Et que cette tentative de mener les politiques en dehors du regard citoyen, c'est un effet des revendications des ONG et de la société civile. Donc on voit qu'à partir d'une étude de cas extrêmement précise, souvent vous avez deux articles offerts à la lecture, et dans les deux cas, vous avez sûrement vu que Chaline Ronderia part de cas empiriques extrêmement précis, très documentés, etc. Et donc, à partir de ces cas empiriques, on voit comment elle déploie les stratégies différentes des acteurs en place et à des échelles aussi différentes. Voilà pourquoi nous sommes ravis de l'avoir ici. Et je vous donne la parole alors tout de suite pour continuer.
Now we need to turn it on.
Now, to put it back.
We have to put it back as well. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So now it should be.
Okay. Good morning and thank you very much, Jerome, for the invitation and for the very kind introduction. In fact, listening to you, that's about as much French as I can follow. And I thought, actually, you've summarized the paper better than I could have, and we could start with the discussion immediately. So if those of you who want to enter into a discussion, just get your questions ready. Maybe I'll just talk for half an hour and we'll see what you need as an input, and then we can talk about some of the issues around the paper. Let me maybe start with a remark and three stories so that you have some idea of the context of the work. I was trained as a sociologist and as an anthropologist. If I speak English very fast, just raise your hand and tell me. I mean, compared to Jerome's French, I'll be very slow. So I don't think you should have a problem, but it's a question also of different accents in English and sometimes vocabulary, which you don't have. So just let me know if I'm too fast or if there is a word which you don't understand, and then I can just write it for you. So I was trained as a sociologist and an anthropologist. I've been working on the anthropology of law, and I was working on family law in India for many years, and realized that the whole discussion on legal pluralism, which is a technical term in sociology and anthropology of law, the term basically means the existence, the coexistence of multiple normative orders simultaneously within the same territory. Yeah? So within a state, say Switzerland, you have several systems of norms which are parallel, coexisting simultaneously, which may overlap with one another, or they may also be in competition with one another. And in the area that I was working in, this was family law, you had in India a state law, and you had several different non-state legal orders. So you had different castes which were regulating their own internal affairs, marriages, divorce, adoption, property, inheritance, etc., according to their own caste norms and regulations. So not only were the norms different from the norms in the state law, but also the institutions which were setting the norms, which were adjudicating disputes, and which were regulating social life were not state courts, but independent councils of different castes. So this would be a classic case of what anthropologists have described since many, many years as legal pluralism, the existence of next to state law, parallel to state law, non-state norms and non-state institutions and non-state arenas for adjudication. But this was, if you like, all within the state or parallel but below the state, to use a very simple kind of above and below analogy, which I don't like. But basically, if you like, it's infrastate law, which is the plurality of law. So next to state law, you have infrastate institutions, sub-state level institutions. And this is how anthropologists have been talking about legal pluralism since many, many years, referring to colonial Africa and colonial Indonesia, which is where the whole discussion of legal pluralism starts, and also religious pluralism in law. So you have a lot of Muslim or traditional religious authorities. And then when I started looking at the work that I was doing on how ideas about conservation practices, natural resource conservation, biodiversity, or some of the other things I was interested in, ideas about family planning and the number of children which people should have, when I started looking at these areas, I realized that these are areas in which there is enormous legal pluralism, although nobody talks about it as legal pluralism. So I applied the original idea, which has been in anthropology for a long time in the 60s and 70s and 80s, in the field of family law. I applied this idea of legal pluralism to understand the plurality of laws in areas like biodiversity, like family planning norms, like population control programs, or like patent laws or infrastructure resettlement programs. So all kinds of other areas which have not been considered to be areas of legal plurality. And the other dimension which I discovered in this is you not only have state law and infrastate law, but you also have suprastate law. So in all of these areas, next to the state, you not only have different categories of norms coming from the civil society, coming from social movements, coming from NGOs, which we can see as infrastate or subnational institutional level, but also from international organizations and supranational levels. So basically, I was transferring both the idea of legal pluralism into this area and then also making the argument that this legal pluralism has also a transnational dimension. It's not just international law, but the international law is one among a set of plural normative orders which regulate certain areas within state life, territory, simultaneously with other competing normative orders. So that was sort of one transposition. So that what I did is in this area to start looking at what happens when state law gets fractured, state sovereignty gets fractured by the existence of other normative orders. And I came up with the idea that we have to rethink the idea of sovereignty, which we have, because what we have are multiple sovereignties in effect. And let me give you an example out of my own work. I was doing field work in Western India, in the state of Uttar Pradesh, on family planning programs, which the USAID, this is the US American, this is the equivalent of DEITSA here in Switzerland. So it's the bilateral international development aid organization of the US government, USAID. USAID was running many programs of population control and family planning in India. And what I found was that in areas in which, we'll start the story the other way around, the government of India has a very liberal abortion law. In India, it's possible to get abortion on demand in any state clinic or state hospital, free of charge, up to the 12th, sometimes even 14th week of pregnancy. You don't have to go through any kind of complicated medical procedure in order to have indications for this kind of an abortion. And there are many reasons why this is so, but that's not what I want to go into. There is a very liberal abortion law. Abortion is free of charge, and it is available everywhere in state-run medical institutions. Interestingly, in all the areas in which the USAID was carrying out its population planning programs, the US government law of restricted abortions applies on Indian territory, because the money which comes with the USAID program comes conditional on certain norms being transported together with that money. If I have a chalk, I can... There is something called the Tihart Amendment in the U.S. Constitution. This in the U.S. Congress. This is a Republican congressman, an ultra-conservative Republican congressman, who introduced an amendment saying the U.S. government should not put any of its developmental program money into any health program which allows abortion. So now you have two sets of norms: a state law in India, which should apply to all citizens of India, and you have a U.S. norm introduced through a United States Congress amendment, making U.S. aid conditional on the introduction of a totally different norm to the state norm. So you have two sets of norms, a supranational one, and so this is why I'm saying this is not international law. So we have lots of supranational norms which are not international law. We can call them, if you like, project law. Because this is law, norms, which travel with development aid projects. And these can be biodiversity projects, these can be resettlement projects, this can be infrastructure projects, etc. If you read the paper, you will have examples of World Bank norms traveling. And so you have this kind of a transnational layer of norms which travel with projects, and they have all kinds of effects in the countries in which they are being used. First of all, they lead to legal plurality. Yeah, that is clear. But they also lead to a plural sovereignty, because the government of India gives up sovereignty, if you like, over certain areas of regulation, yeah, and allows whoever is carrying out a project to temporarily, for the duration of that project, introduce their own norms into what is sovereign Indian territory. And therefore, what you get is, on the one hand, you get overlapping sovereignties, and you get a differentiation of citizenship rights. I'm sorry, my students are always complaining about my handwriting, but it's better that you have at least some of the terms on the paper. So that what happens is that if you introduce this kind of a plurality of norms leading to a pluralization of sovereignty over a territory and citizenships, then of course you introduce basically a differentiation of citizenship rights, because what happens is those Indian citizens who are governed by Indian norms, and there are those Indian citizens who get governed by whatever is the project law introduced into this territory for this particular point of time for the particular project. So there are several effects of the transnationalization of law, which I started tracing in the projects in which I was doing my empirical fieldwork. So that's sort of one context to this entire argument and to the paper. Let me give you two other quick stories so that you see where some of the ideas are coming from. I was tracing these kinds of legal plurality with regard to resettlement norms of the World Bank. When the World Bank builds a dam or gives money for infrastructure development, for building of roads, for building of railways, for building of any kind of big infrastructure, then of course there is a lot of displacement which takes place, because people have to be moved from the areas in which they are living, and they are resettled forcibly to other areas in order to allow this kind of infrastructure development. So the World Bank has a lot of norms with regard to who should be paid, how much compensation, should there be forced resettlement or not, what kind of resettlement programs and compensation must be agreed to in advance, how should it be carried out, by whom should it be carried out, etc., etc. And then it has special policies on indigenous people and indigenous people's rights with regard to displacement, because a lot of the infrastructure development takes place in areas with indigenous populations. So when I was doing fieldwork in the World Bank on this area, what struck me was something very interesting. I was interviewing World Bank and IMF economists and lawyers on the kinds of programs they were involved in, and they kept saying to me, actually, we just don't have the kind of power you think that we have, because the power is with the sovereign state. We only make a loan to Russia or to India or to Indonesia, and then it's a sovereign government which decides what to do with this money, and we cannot interfere in the political internal affairs of any country. And then I said, asked about examples, etc., and then they said, look, we give money to the Russians, they sign conditionalities with us, and then they don't stick to any of these conditionalities. And nevertheless, we give them the next loan, and then we agree to another set of conditionalities, and they don't stick to those conditionalities, and we give them the third loan. So basically, we are totally powerless. When I was doing interviews in the WTO in Geneva, looking at patent rights, interviewing WTO officials, the WTO officials said, the WTO is a very small organization. We have a budget which is smaller than the budget of the Sierra Club, an environmental NGO in the US. We have no power at all. We only make recommendations. We are servants to countries who are sovereign states, who are our members. Then I was doing interviews in the ministry in Delhi, asking all these bureaucrats about how all of these norms are being made, how they are being applied, and then said, we don't have any power. These norms come either from Geneva or from Washington, D.C. And so suddenly, in the year 2000, I was sitting there with these fieldwork notes, and I was saying to myself, where has all the power gone? Nobody seems to have power in this world. Everybody thinks somebody else has power. And therefore, we have a very diffuse power, which is hard to pin down, and therefore I think it's important to think about ethnographically as to what kind of structures of a accountability or non-accountability are we living in today? Because if as citizens we cannot say this is where the power lies, then of course we do not know whom to hold accountable for policies. And since my material was showing such a lot of diffusion, I started thinking about the nature of the state here. And some of you are political scientists in the room, I hear, and you know that in political science there is a very simple distinction which is being made by many, many political scientists between strong states and weak states, and then come the failed states or the rogue states, but those we leave aside. And I started thinking to myself, there is something wrong with this distinction, because India, Russia, China, Mexico, Indonesia are by no description weak states. And so I was thinking of the kind of power these states exercise, how do they play this game, and this is when I came up with the idea of looking at the strategies of the state, not at state capacity or incapacity, which is what strength or weakness in the political science discussion of strong and weak states is about, but looking at how the state renders itself unaccountable, both to its citizens and to international organizations. And in this context, I developed the idea of the cunning state. So these were sort of two of the stories which were important for me to frame some of the kind of material I've been looking at. How is it that I came up with some of these ideas to look at it? And what are my theoretical and political concerns? So let me go through quickly some of the major arguments, introduced a couple of the terms, show you maybe with one empirical example, the kind of material I'm looking at, and then we can discuss with one another. So the first argument that I make in this paper is to say that a rhetoric of accountability accompanies growing non-accountability of all four sets of actors of global governance. Multinational corporations, states, international organizations, and NGOs, if you look at four major actors of global governance, each has a rhetoric of transparency and accountability, but in practice, if you look at the structure of this architecture, it is such that each is able to render itself unaccountable. So we have multinational corporations which are accountable only to their shareholders. We have NGOs. We don't know who they're accountable to at all.
I'm sorry, but I don't understand the word
accountability.
Accountability.
Is there a French word for it? In German, we would say Rechenschaftspflicht. I'm sorry, I don't know the French word at all. In German, it would be Rechenschaftspflichtigkeit, Rechenschaft, to be responsible to somebody. Yeah? As a citizen, I can ask the state to be accountable to me, to give an account of itself. So I, as a citizen, have entitlements against the state. I can call the state to account. It must account itself to me. So it has certain responsibilities. And duties, and one of the duties of the state would be to be accountable to its citizens. But similarly, of course, one of the duties of international organizations would be, and now is the question, whom are they accountable to? Whom is the World Bank accountable to? The World Bank claims it is accountable, and the WTO also, it claims it is accountable only to its members. And it says our members are nation states, and therefore we are only accountable to sovereign elected nation states. NGOs and social movements have been arguing that the World Bank and the IMF cannot be merely accountable to nation states. They should be accountable to those who are affected by their policies and their programs. So there is always about in accountability, the first question which you ask is, to whom is someone accountable? So in the question of the state, it's clear. The state is accountable to its citizens. But whom are international organizations accountable to? Whom are multinational corporations accountable to? So this is an important question both theoretically and it's an important question empirically. How do we talk about accountability? And what is it accountable for? So these are questions when I show you my material on the World Bank, I'll talk exactly about to whom is the World Bank accountable and what is it accountable for. So here there is, as far as the World Bank is concerned, and I'll come to that in the last 10 minutes of the talk, there is a huge debate. The World Bank claims it's only accountable to its member states, which are sovereign elected governments, and NGOs and social movements claim that the World Bank must be accountable to those whose lives are affected by World Bank policies and programs. And therefore, they must have a voice in the workings of the bank and in the implementation of its policies. And for what exactly should the World Bank be accountable? So this is something we'll come to in a moment. But so we have the question of unaccountability of international organizations, the question of the unaccountability in a way of NGOs. This is what my students don't like when I say NGOs are not accountable to anybody because everyone thinks NGOs are good things and therefore people don't like this idea. But the question is, to whom is an NGO like Greenpeace accountable? And you can say it's accountable to its members, but then comes the question, is it legitimate if an NGO like Greenpeace intervenes in the name of environment in what the state considers to be its own domestic internal affairs? With what legitimacy can an NGO put pressure to do this? And of course it says we do this in the name of a public. And this is a transnational public. It says we do this in the name of a transnational civil society. But these are major questions of whether, to and whom, an NGO, an international NGO, but even a national NGO is accountable to. That's not something I go into much in this paper, but I have done another paper on this idea, so we can talk about NGO and social movement accountability. But what I'm interested with the idea of the current state is the idea to whom is the state accountable is clear. The state should be accountable to its citizens. And of course, when the state has taken money from the IMF and the World Bank, has taken credits from the IMF and the World Bank, loans from these institutions or from the USAID, then the state is of course accountable to those from whom it has taken these credits for fulfilling certain credit conditionalities. So the state has entered into an agreement with these organizations and must be accountable to those. Now the idea of the cunning state is to argue that the state is able to render itself non-accountable both to its citizens and to international donors by shifting the blame from the one to the other. So when it comes to the World Bank, the government of India, bureaucrats will argue, we are a democracy, we can only push through certain policies and programs. If we were to do things that you want us to do, we would never be able to manage the country. There will be chaos, and we've seen that. I mean, for example, in Indonesia, but not only, in Haiti as well, there were huge riots after the World Bank, the IMF insisted that the government put up the prices of food. So there were food riots against the price raise which the IMF had dictated to the government. So of course these governments are arguing that we are elected sovereign governments, so they tell the bank or the IMF that they are responsible and accountable to their citizens. However, at home, when it comes to domestic policy making, they say to their citizens, our hands are tied, there's nothing else we can do, this is globalization, we have the IMF conditionality, which, or the WTO patent law, and we are forced to do what is prescribed by these institutions. And of course, this is one of the arguments that I'm making is that we should not take the rhetoric of the state about its own weakness at face value. All states at the moment are claiming to be weak. And it's the interest of state elites everywhere to claim that they are weak, they are not in a position to do very much, because this gives you a lot of maneuver room for doing things which you want to do by putting the blame on someone else. In the European Union, this is the usual game of saying the EU wants us to do this, that, and the other, so we can't do otherwise. Right? So there's a shifting of responsibility through the insistence that you are basically weak, which is a claim that you as an actor don't have much power. So this is the power to claim weakness leads to way of getting out of accountability to citizens and to international organizations. So this is sort of one of the arguments I'm making. The other is an ethnographic, it's a methodological argument, and it says, let's not think about states in terms of capacities and incapacities, but look at state strategies and state tactics in very specific ethnographic contexts. And this is an argument which is made both, in my view, for anthropologists on the one hand and political scientists and sociologists on the other hand, because methodologically it makes an anthropological argument to say we can do an ethnography of the state, and an ethnography of state would be an ethnography of state practices. And these practices can be documents, of course, yeah, but they can also be the kind of laws, they can also be the kind of policies. On the other hand, it can also be the kind of actions being carried out by bureaucrats, judges, in the whatever sphere one is looking at. But as far as political scientists, sociologists are concerned, I think methodologically the argument I would like to make here is that I think therefore it's very, very important to look at individual cases ethnographically before we come to generalizations about what has happened to state power or sovereignty or law in under globalization. So it's making a plea for all those towards all those disciplines which work at high levels of abstraction, usually quantitatively, with all of these kinds of issues, to say there is a merit in looking at qualitative case studies and thick descriptions, ethnographies, in order to get to some kind of understanding of what kind of processes of globalization are at work at levels at which normally one doesn't look for them, and that is at sort of the micro level, or if you like, at a level which connects the micro level to certain macro structures. Yeah? So this is what, if you know the work of the Komarovs, Jean and John Komarov, they have a very good article where they say you have to do ethnography at an awkward scale. Yeah? So this is the whole discussion on scales at the moment in anthropology, trying to understand at what scale can we study certain phenomena. Can we study these phenomena as we used to study, only at the level of villages, micro practices, etc.? Or if we can't, how should we look at things in different scalar perspectives? And Komarovs are making an interesting argument, saying that if we want to understand the kind of transformations of law, of state practices, of citizenship rights, etc., of sovereignty in today's world, then we can only do ethnography on an awkward scale. We have phenomena which don't fit neatly at a particular scale. So we have to look at them at different scales and then try and relate the different scales to one another. And this is a problem for anthropologists, because we are usually trained to do ethnography at a very micro scale, closed communities, communities which are circumscribed, which are usually face-to-face communities. so that we always, we have to rethink the kind of ethnography we need to do if we want to look at phenomena at what they call an awkward scale. So this is sort of, on one hand, on the other hand, it's a methodological argument. Okay, in the paper, if you've read it, it's an argument also, if you like, partly with Hart and Negri, but also then without, against Hart and Negri. But that's something I don't want to go into at the moment. We can go back to it in the discussion, if you like. But that's sort of a side argument in the paper. Then what I do in the paper is to look at four pathways of transnationalization of law and legal plurality. So it's important to look at the roots. Roots in the sense of the ways through which law travels. If you're looking at traveling norms, then it's important to look at the pathways, the routes of travel. And then in the paper, I identify four different pathways through which transnational legal plurality can be studied. I look at the simultaneous operation of multiple international or supranational norms which compete with one another. I just gave you an example of the USAID and the abortion law. Secondly, I look at plurality within state law, where state law itself can consist of plural and sometimes even norms which don't fit well with one another. These can be as a result of disjunction between different ministries. For example, there's a wonderful case study. I haven't worked on this myself, but there is a very, very good paper by Rose on Vietnam, in which she traces legal pluralism in Vietnam by showing how different ministries and different international agencies are in charge of different areas of Vietnamese law in such a way that there is no coherence between these areas. So, the Australians, the Canadians come and rewrite Vietnamese timber laws. The Australians are in charge of rewriting Vietnam's maritime laws. The USAID is in charge of rewriting the health norms. The World Bank comes and rewrites labor laws and financial regulation laws. And then you have a totally chaotic legal pluralism without any coherence at all, because different international agencies have introduced different sets of norms in different areas of life. So you can have interesting cases where this kind of legal plurality can lead to basically, and that's something you will see in the Indian case as well, that legal plurality has certain advantages because it gives you alternative sets of norms. It gives you different sets of norms to play off against one another and alternative arena of adjudication. So you can, if you don't find justice in one arena, you can move your case to another arena. But legal plurality can often lead to legal uncertainty. So that legal plurality can come at a cost. And you can have very different kinds of mixtures of advantages and disadvantages in a situation of transnational legal plurality. Yeah? So one of the things you can do when you have alternative sets of norms is you can jump scales. And I can give you a good example from my own work. I was working on the World Bank project. The World Bank financed a very, very big dam in India on the Narmada River. It's called the Narmada Dam, and the World Bank was the major funder of this dam. This dam got into a lot of controversy, one because it destroyed enormous amounts of forests, so there was a huge ecological problem with the dam, and it displaced 100,000 people forcibly out of the areas in which they were living, of which more than three quarters were indigenous people. So the protest movement against this dam, in a normal case, you would have thought, would go to a national court or to the national parliament. Instead of which, this protest movement decided not to address the state at all. It bypassed the Indian state and went straight to put pressure on the World Bank. In order to put pressure on the World Bank, it used US Congress hearings. So it addressed the US Congress and not the Indian Parliament. Mm-hmm. And this is what John Ruggie calls,
it's not my expression, but this is the political scientist John Ruggie's expression, he calls
scale jumping. And this would be an example of scale jumping, that you bypass the national scale, the national level, national institutions, and you go straight onto supranational institutions in order to put pressure on the state. Now, scale jumping has advantages because you can use, if you know that the Indian law is not going to be favorable and Indian courts are not going to be favorable to your case, then it's better to jump scales and put pressure on the World Bank to withdraw from this dam. And you know that the Indian Parliament is not going to be responsive to this particular action because it thinks infrastructure projects are a good thing, and therefore, and it doesn't worry about the displacement of the poor, so therefore it might give you alternative sets of norms and it might give you alternatives arena of adjudication. However, for those on the ground who are being forcibly displaced, the fact that so many alternatives exist can also lead to legal uncertainty because it's unclear which sets of norms apply to them or which don't, and especially if you have project law in the same area, different sets of rules apply to different sets of people or over different sets of time, because a project will finish in 5 years. Do the norms carry on after the project money has finished? Are the norms taken over into national law? If they are not, what happens? Who is paid compensation according to what law? So what can happen then in this case is that you have in the same area two dams being built or two roads being built, with one with World Bank money and the other without World Bank money. And the people who are displaced from this area will have compensation at the sum of X, and those who are displaced through a non-World Bank will get compensation X minus, because the norms for compensation are different. And this happens in not only in India, but in all developing countries. For example, Japanese banks give credits for the same kind of infrastructure development, and they give it without any conditionality on compensation for resettlement. So you have all the time the donors being played off one against the other by states who can say, okay, we take your money, but we don't adhere to the conditionalities. The minute the World Bank says, but you promise to pay compensation, they say, okay, we don't want your money anymore, we'll get the Japanese banks to finance the dam or the road. So there is, and that's why in the title of the paper I had the dance between donors and dependent states, because there's a tangle. With donors and dependent states can go, they can part company, they can choose another partner, and the ones who are left without any rights to be implemented are the citizens, because it's unclear for them, do these norms apply, do these norms apply, when do they apply, how long do they apply, who will apply these norms, because you can't take the World Bank norms and fight a case in a national court, because the court in India will say we apply Indian norms, but the government of India has agreed for the project duration to apply World Bank norms. Then the question is, who should implement these norms? Right? So then I talk about a forum, a new forum in which these get implemented and what happens there, but the problem is, so you have legal uncertainty. And the third aspect of this particular idea of legal pluralism is we not only have alternative sets of norms and alternative arena, but we also have many sets of actors. So if you usually talk to political scientists and to lawyers and you ask them, who does norm setting? Who produces law? They will say the state. And what we see in all of these cases, in my case, is lot of the new norms today are being produced in civil society. They are being produced by NGOs. So NGOs are not only being watchdogs of the norms, which is what we know from Greenpeace or from Amnesty International, which would be a wonderful example of a good watchdog of human rights norms, but they are also producing new norms. And they then have varying coalitions with states, with other NGOs, with international organizations to push through and institutionalize these norms and also then to implement these norms. So you have a multiple number of norms, you have multiple arena, but you also have multiple norm-producing, norm-setting, and norm-implementing actors. And this is the constellation of legal plurality, which can have advantages, but which can also have severe problems. So that's the second kind of process of transnationalization of norms that I'm looking at. The third, what I'm looking at is different actors who are pluralizing the sets of norms available. So I'm looking at civil society actors, NGOs, and social movements as new norm-producing and norm-watching actors. And finally, I am looking at project law, which is what I just described to you, international organizations which temporarily introduce their own norms into the nation-state territory for a particular period of time. Okay, let me just give you two brief examples of the kind of material I've been looking at, and then we can get to the discussion. One case that I have looked at in great detail is patents, patent law. I don't know, patent is, it's okay, in French it's... It's a totally different word, okay. So these are patents which are under the WTO intellectual property rights. Law is the, I don't know if this is something you're familiar with. This is under the new WTO regulations. You have the possibility to patent plant genetic, biogenetic resources as part of the new regulation of intellectual property rights. So you have property not only in things, so it's not just that I own a bottle, this not, would not be intellectual property, but if I own the idea of the bottle, this would be intellectual property. And this is the kinds of, it's not the same, but it's the kind of things maybe that you're familiar with in all the discussions on copyrights about music, whether music can be downloaded illegally from the internet or not, whether the Chinese are contravening the copyright conventions on films, music, etc. Copyrights are not quite the same thing as patents, but they are both two different kinds of intellectual property. Whom does it belong to? And so one of the things I've looked at are two kinds of patents. Patents on the neem tree in India and patents on basmati rice, which most of you eat, I suppose. Now the question is whose intellectual property is basmati rice? You would normally have thought, like champagne, growing in Champagne, it would be the property of the French farmer, and this is what the French government has been trying to protect in this particular regime, which is called the TRIPS. This is trade-related intellectual property rights in the WTO. This is the legal framework, regulatory framework. And similarly, one would have thought basmati rice is the intellectual property of the farmers who have been growing and cultivating and modifying the seeds of the basmati rice in India and in Pakistan since hundreds of years. Suddenly comes an American multinational company called Ricetech in Texas and says they own, they had patents, they file for patents on basmati rice and say basmati rice is their intellectual property and they want to sell it, market it as Texamati rice, Texas, and they turn it into basmati becomes Texamati and they want to market it globally as Texamati rice. So there's a huge fight on the patents to the basmati as there is a fight about the patents to oil, pesticides, etc. from the neem tree. The neem tree grows in India, Pakistan, also Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, but also in large parts of Africa. And the question is, who owns the plant genetic material and the processes through which these can be turned into natural herbicides, fungicides, pesticides, etc. And what I describe in the paper is the legal battle for these patents, and that is the claims of the multinationals on the one hand, and the counterclaims of the social movements and the NGOs, which are transnational social movements, against these patents as intellectual, taking away of intellectual property. So the two big sort of slogans under which this discussion takes place is biopiracy, so this is pirating the biological plant genetic heritage of developing countries, and colonialism and intellectual colonialism in the area of patent rights. And this is the whole case on neem tree patents, which I describe in the paper. I discuss the question of basmati patents, and I describe how this particular contest takes place. Theoretically, two arguments are interesting for me here. One, I'm interested in what the Komarovs have also called now the judicialization of politics. So theoretically, the argument I'm making using this case is that today it's not possible just to have political mobilization along all of these lines. You have to turn this into a legal issue. Because the multinationals are staking their claims using certain kinds of legal norms and legal apparatus. The fight against, the battle against these claims also has to be a judicial battle. So what you are getting is increasingly a judicialization of politics, where political mobilization goes hand in hand with court cases at all levels, all scales. They can be local courts, they can be national courts, they can be international courts, they can be supranational institutions, but at all scales you are getting more and more of a judicialization of politics. So this is one argument that I'm making. This is, which is not to say that once a case goes to court, it is only a matter of the judiciary. It is still a matter of politics. That's why in the paper I use the word legal politics, because I'm trying to make the argument that legal processes and legal cases and political mobilization are linked processes. You can't see them apart from one another. Just as in the Basmati case, I show that the victory about striking down certain patents could only be won by enormous political mobilization transnationally, which put so much pressure on the US patenting authority that it struck down a lot of the claims. But you cannot do it only through political pressure in parliament, because once certain things are framed in a legal regulatory framework, the challenges to that framework have to be legal. So that there is an increasing amount of areas of our life which are all being judicialized, and because these areas of life are being judicialized, all contestation and mobilization along those areas can no longer be simply political mobilization, it also has to be a judicial mobilization. This, however, has a paradoxical consequence. On the one hand, of course, since you have legal plurality, you can use alternative norms, you can use alternative areas of adjudication, but one consequence of judicialization, it doesn't have to be, but it can be and often is, the depoliticization. yeah, or what I use even Krastev's phrase in this paper, I say, a democracy without choices. Because what happens is when power shifts within the state from the parliament to the law courts, you have a depoliticization, which we're seeing all over Europe. Low voter turnout, people don't want to go vote in the elections because they say it makes no difference. Yeah? You have, this is why Ivan Krastev has a nice phrase, he calls it democracy without choices. So on the one hand, paradoxically, you have the diffusion of global democracy all over the globe in the last 10, 15 years, but a hollowing out of the substance of that democracy, because you can elect leaders and parties, but you can't change the policies. So the set of neoliberal policies which governs many, many of these areas that I'm talking about are policies in which there is no choice. So you can vote politicians in and out of power, but you cannot, through your vote, affect the kinds of policies which your governments follow. And therefore, you have one of the arguments I make in the paper is what you have is, and that's why power gets diffused, not only because power gets diffused between the different scales and between plural sets of institutions and international and supranational institutions and national institutions, but because through judicialization, if you like, if we can describe the one as the vertical movement of power from the state to suprastate, or also substate, because NGOs, etc., would be then substate in this kind of axis and terminology. Judicialization of politics is a horizontal movement of power from parliament to the courts. So a lot of power shifts within the state, on the one hand from the legislature to the judiciary, and on the other hand from the legislature to the administration. Because all the negotiations with the World Bank, with the IMF, with the WTO are done by bureaucrats and not by parliamentarians. And the conditionalities of the World Bank and the IMF are secret, they are not disclosed to the parliaments of the countries. They are not put to vote. Citizens have no idea what conditionalities the governments have agreed to, and they therefore cannot take any influence over them. And this increases the power of the bureaucracy of the administration in all of these countries enormously. So it's not as if the state, and that is the larger argument in all of this, is to say, it's not as if the state is withering away or becoming weak, etc., but there are all kinds of shifts in the nature of state power, a lot of reconfiguration of state power, which we can map by these kinds of ethnographic look at the processes of where power shifts within the state, where power shifts to institutions outside the state, where power can shift to non-state actors, and then there is a shift to non-state actors. And the theoretical argument I'm making there then is you have a blurring of two boundaries, the blurring of the boundary between public and private, and the blurring of the boundaries between national and international. Right? Because when non-state actors become actors in the field of law, then of course the state is no longer has the monopoly over law. You get private actors who are norm-setting actors, and you get a blurring of the boundary between public and private, and you get a blurring of the boundary between national and transnational when you don't know at what scale policies are being made or programmatic decisions are being taken. I think I can stop at that. The last section of the paper is about the World Bank. It gives you ethnographic material on the bank, showing how different sets of actors are involved, the Indian state, but not the federal state, the local state, and the World Bank, in negotiations around norms of resettlement, and it shows about how civil society actors are involved both in implementing these programs for the World Bank on the one hand and agitating against the non-implementation of that program by the cunning state on the other hand. So you can have civil society on both sides of the divide, and I try to show the kinds of constellations in which there is scale jumping, judicialization of politics, and a shifting of these boundaries here at all of these levels and scales.
Thank you.
procedurally it was done in the right way. Yeah? The question is it socially legitimate to have certain kinds of norms which disenfranchises lots of people and deprives them of equality of certain outcomes? Now, therefore, politically, we would follow is, I think we need to rethink as citizens where accountability lies, and where accountability lies can only be understood if you understand where power lies. But the problem, however, is that it's very difficult to make abstract generalizations on this. So basically, in every case, one has to have a very clear understanding of where, in this particular context, power lies, their accountability would also lie, and then politics or political action would follow, which follows from such an analysis. And to say how we could take things about it. I don't think the answer could be international organizations have to deal differently with states. I think that there is a lot of danger in this game jumping politically. It has advantages, as I tried to show you. The danger in this game jumping is that basically we legitimize, as citizens, international organizations and delegitimize our own states and our own legislatures. And I think that this is a two-edged, double-edged sword, because we weaken and delegitimize exactly those actors, like the state, whom at the same time we are demanding accountability. And I think this is, I mean, these are some of the, and one of the arguments in the paper is, if you like, to say, we have caught in a lot of paradoxical processes at this point of time. A lot of the left, which used to be very anti-state, yeah, because it saw the state as the major enemy for lots of things, now in the face of all this pressure from multinationals and international organizations is discovering that the state is a major ally. So suddenly the state becomes an ally for lots of NGOs and certain movements, but not always in certain contexts. And that's why one of the arguments I'm making in the paper is we need to look at issue-based alliances rather than ideological politics. Because these old alliances, which were along ideological lines, don't function. You get very different constellations and coalitions depending on issues. So if you look at the Kyoto process, how the Kyoto Protocol got signed, you will see a totally different alliance of actors than if you look at how the Global Compact on Poverty came about. And I think these shifting constellations of actors and alliances, they are short-lived, they are temporary issue-based alliances, and they're shifting alliances. I mean, you can sometimes have, and these are the paradoxes in which we live, you can sometimes have NGOs who need multinational corporations as allies against the state. For example, in the African case, when states sometimes, like in Nigeria, in the Shell and the Ogoni case, of course Shell is a problem in this constellation, no question. But sometimes the NGOs try to use Shell in order to put pressure on the Nigerian government, because they found that in public relations campaigns, it's much easier to name and shame Shell than to name and shame their own government. And therefore, you suddenly get an alliance with a multinational corporation who is no friend of yours, basically, but at the moment it's a good ally to put pressure. You know, like in the Indian case in Narmada, when the social movements used the US Congress to put pressure on the World Bank to withdraw from the project and to put pressure on the Indian government. And just as a footnote to this, the major allies in the US Congress were the Republicans, because the Republicans don't like the World Bank. So the Democrats were on the side of the US government, the Republicans were looking for something to beat the Democratic government with. They didn't want money, too much money from the US to be given to the World Bank. The World Bank was in a credit crunch and was not getting as much money on the Wall Street borrowing, being able to borrow money on the Wall Street at that time as it could have. And therefore, the Republicans, the Indian followers to the pressure of the US government and the World Bank. But this is a limited alliance. It's not as if, you know, they are your allies through all issues. Suddenly you come to trade issues and patent, and they are suddenly not your allies anymore. And so these are some of the kinds of constellations in which I think we need to think about politics. I think there are no easy answers to this, but it's important at least that we have ideas which help us analyze these transformations, because if we don't understand the transformation of the state itself, then it's very difficult to know how to act politically in this context. So there is, of course, an immediate argument about political action which follows from a certain kind of theoretical analysis. But of course, you, it may not. I mean, you can say, I'm not interested in political action, I'm only interested in analysis. But you can look at the analysis regardless of its political implications.
I actually have a question for clarification. I enjoyed your presentation very much. I need some clarification with regards to norms, law, and not laws. You use them sometimes interchangeably. As you said, for instance, NGOs are norm setters. But obviously, they can't set the law.
Exactly.
So there is a distinction. I would like to, I would like some more. Well, how you make a distinction, and in particular the distinction, because of course with the law you have, the state has the monopoly on making laws.
That's
and enforcing it, as well as police, etc., etc. And I would like to hear a bit more about the role of constitutional law, because within the industrialized countries, the constitutional law has a particular function in creating a certain kind of homogeneity. And obviously, we have a lot of different cases here where we actually have much more heterogeneity. So I'm wondering, what is then the role, the difference between norms, laws, and constitutional law?
Well,
and just to come to the end, because I'm actually interested, because you started this very interesting remarks in the actual root and family law, and that there is a long tradition of heterogeneity with regard as well to norms and laws. And I was wondering is that what is actually the function of law with regard to social formation? So I'm interested in kind of looking at it more from a nursing perspective, looking at particular at constitutional law as a way of ensuring social integration. So kind of having a law at a state that can address, say, oh well, I want to have my rights, which is a way of kind of integrating into something which we call the nation state. So I'm wondering if there is this heterogeneity, the long tradition of heterogeneity, what is then the new form of social formation with a new kind of heterogeneity? Obviously, there is still a continuation of the heterogeneity with regard to norms and laws. But this is actually the interest in my interest in
very, very large question, or there are large sets of questions. Let me start first with law is absolutely, you're absolutely right. In this sense, law is, in a technical sense, only state law, because the state has the monopoly over the production of law. And therefore, when I talk about NGOs or the World Bank, I'm looking at them as producers of norms and of not law. We, by law, mean that law is something which has a basis in the legislature. However, now comes the problem. We have what we today the political scientists and also the lawyers call soft law. And soft law are treaties, protocols, best practices, etc., which have credit conditionalities, would be an example of soft law. So these are quasi-judicial instruments which have legal effects without being passed by the legislature. So there are, or there's already in the strict domain even of law, you have sort of a blurring of the boundary into what are called soft law instruments. A good example in my paper of these soft law instruments are the so-called OP and OD operational policies and operational directives of the World Bank.
these are the norms, and I said, to whom is the bank accountable and what does it have accountability for? The worker says, it does not have accountability in terms of international law. So you cannot hold the World Bank accountable for contravening international human rights law. The World Bank says, we are only accountable according to the standards and norms which we have set ourselves as an institution. And these are our operational policies and directives. And we can only be held responsible with regard to whether we implement those or not. So these would be sort of, in a sense, quasi-judicial. But you cannot take these operational principles and policies to a state court or to an international court. You can only take them to the World Bank adjudication mechanism, which is the new inspection panel set up in 1993, which can adjudicate on these. So you have already, you know, another arena, which is a new arena. These are quasi-judicial arenas again. So you have a sort of pluralization of arena here. Norms can be of all kinds, including, for example, policies. And policies can be have lots of norms, which are not law. Mm-hmm. So the whole, I mean, in German, I think Habermas would have great problems, because in German you cannot make the distinction between politics and policy. It's beides Politik. And then Habermas has terminological problem already. But in English you can have policies, and policies can be politics, but policies can also not be law. And one of the reasons why the World Bank and states operate often by making policy and not law is they don't have to go through parliament, and those policies cannot be challenged in a court of law. But because they are administrative norms, you can implement them in all kinds of contexts, and the administration can use those norms in order to regulate many areas of social life. So you can have, for example, in many countries, a resettlement policy without having a resettlement law. India is a wonderful example, which has never passed a resettlement law. So then you have, so you can have norms of many kinds which may not be law. And they can still be at the level of state institutions. In the family law case, and then I come to your last set of questions, I'm talking about not only a heterogeneity. And you can have this heterogeneity, as I tried to show you in the Vietnam case, you can have heterogeneity at the level of the state law, because you have a heterogeneity of actors, and then you can have incoherent state law. Heterogeneity need not always be incoherent, but in this case, you have a good case. In the EU, and that's not my domain, so I will not be able to give you good empirical examples, because I don't work on it. But colleagues tell me that there is considerable plurality and also much more incoherence than we actually would think. However, of course, it's not a case like Vietnam. I think Vietnam is, if you take a spectrum, then you would have Vietnam as, of course, one end of the scala of incoherence. But because of the overlapping EU norms and national norms, you have, you know, and then, of course, there is a whole level in the EU which we shouldn't forget when we talk about norms. You have, or we talk about law. See, lawyers are usually talking about black letter law, so they talk about law on the books. But law on the books is not law in practice. And I'll give you a good EU example, because it's a very revealing example. When there is an EU norm on genetically modified food, in Germany, there's a huge public debate on whether the German parliament should take it or not take it, whether consumers want it or don't want it, etc. In Italy, there is never a debate. And then, what do you make of this? And I was thinking about it for a long time, and I have talked with colleagues who work on these things, and they agreed with me. The explanation is very simple. Because in Germany, once a norm is enshrined into state law, then people take it very seriously, because they know that once it is taken over as a norm, it has ramifications and effects, and people can, citizens can take it to court, and the state has a relative similarity sort of between law in the books and law in practice. In Italy, it's like India. Law in the books are totally different from law in practice. You can have all kinds of things on the books, and nothing gets implemented. So you don't need such a huge discussion, because they say, okay, let them pass the law, we just want to wait. So where you have a huge discrepancy between law in the books and law in the practice, of course you have a different politics around those norms, and there you pass into laws. Now, I give you this kind of example very specifically because I want to get away from the idea that Habermas has, that European constitutional democracies all function in a totally different way from the way South Africa, India, and Brazil function. So that one of my arguments would be, and this is why I want to look at state practices, and I think when we start looking at state practices, a lot of the EU states are going to look very different from Habermasian states. And I think at the back of Habermasian state, ideal constitutional democracy and Verfassungspatriotismus, etc., is a very Bavarian idea of the state. And I think as an anthropologist, you need to think about whether and where Bavarian states exist at all. And if even in the heart of Western Europe, are we really dealing with Bavarian states? At least once you leave five Western European countries, I think we have to start looking at very different kinds of states. So this would be, but to come back to the larger question about heterogeneity of the norms and how it influences the formation of social life in Christian states, this is a huge question which we have to discuss separately. I think I can just give you two very quick answers on this. I think that in Europe, there is a great amount of precision of family norms than most Europeans actually are conscious of and would like to believe. For example, if you start looking in Germany, which is the case I know best in Europe, if you start looking, where do most of the Turkish migrants adjudicate family law cases? Not in German courts by German judges. In some cases, by German judges trained in Turkish law, but applying then totally different norms. If you start asking where do a lot of the Jewish families negotiate their family law cases, you will find in the Jewish council applying Jewish laws. If you look at family law, you will suddenly find that this idea that there is a single set of homogeneous family law which applies to all citizens of a nation state in Europe breaks down very quickly. In England, of course, the material is even more spectacular in the sense you have all kinds of different institutions. You have Sharia courts, you have Indian minorities negotiating law according to their. Give you another interesting example, not from family law. If you've ever thought about the diamond merchants community, which is divided into two communities, the Indians and the Jewish diaspora, they've never taken case to court. They have separate adjudication mechanisms in the community of both communities. So Antwerp business, the diamond business in Antwerp functions to only non-state adjudication, just as the diamond merchants in India, just as the diamond merchants in New York. They are very, very good, not really good ethnography in this sense, because they don't want us to study these cases very carefully, because it's all about trust. And therefore, you would never take it out of the community into a state court. And they're married to one another, so there are lots of kinship ties which get affected in the process. And so this plays into family business. And so you have lots of areas of heterogeneous and plural jurisdiction, which I'm not saying are similar to India and Lebanon, etc., are just very, very heterogeneous as far as family laws are concerned. There are more areas of heterogeneity in Western democracies than political scientists or lawyers would at first sight like to believe. And I think an ethnographic view of that heterogeneity might give us an idea of how to ask different questions. Last point I would make about how is it then that you get citizenship rights, which are similar and that state formation or nation state formation. This is a huge question in India as to how a multilingual, multi-ethnic, multi-religious state which recognizes the plurality of family laws can come together in Italy, because as we have seen, the plurality can be very gender unjust. You can have laws of different communities which can be extremely disadvantageous to women. And the question then is, what kinds of criteria should this plurality meet? Can you say you can have your plurality as long as each community has gender justice, or are there already imposing a criteria onto the plurality which doesn't come under the community itself? And there is a huge debate on this, so I think in this it's very much a question of the perspective. If you want the perspective of the state will say homogeneity of law is necessary. If you want the community perspective, communities say we want heterogeneity, but the question is who speaks in the name of the community. So these are usually older men who want this plurality, but they want the authority to decide what the community norms are. Speak to the woman, the women in the community, and they might prefer state law to community law because they say then they know the institutions they're going to, and the family power play is taken out of this. You can have women who say we would rather have community institutions, but they should be gender justice. So I think this whole question of what kind of societal formations go with heterogeneity is very much a question of whose perspective we want on the issue. Are we looking at it from the perspective which Habermas' question is to look at social formations as a nation-state social formation? But if you look at a gender perspective, we will get a totally different perspective on the question of is integration the right question to ask?
On a le temps de, pour une dernière question. On n'a pas tous les jours Chaline en derrière avec nous, il faut peut-être en profiter pour les poser des questions. Donc, s'il y a encore une question que vous avez à lui adresser.
Oui.
Encore une, vu que c'était une question courte, est-ce qu'il y a une autre question? Peut-être juste avant de vous laisser partir, d'une part vous verrez que la semaine prochaine, avec le cas du droit suisse, on va retrouver ces questions sur une situation très locale, contextuellement. Et j'aimerais peut-être poser une dernière question qui devrait être assez courte à Chalini Randeria. This morning we talked about the Swiss case.
Yes.
And the argument was that cunning states are not only exotic states like India, Mexico, and so on. And you read yesterday an example that could prove or
it's an
make
interesting,
us
it's an interesting case, yeah. I think. I mean, I was reading yesterday, I need to look at it. I just read it in the newspaper yesterday, so I need to follow this to know that there is a little a village called La Champagne. And it was marketing its vines under the label of Champagne and was actually doing very well with this label, the farmers, and had a good market until using the TRIPS, it has part of the TRIPS is what is called geographical indicators. And the geographical indicators means that a certain region, like Basmati, like Champagne, can reserve the name for itself as wines growing in there. So this was a case which the Swiss had to then argue in the WTO context with the French. And what I read yesterday, what I found very interesting, is apparently the Swiss government did a quid pro quo, a trading, and said, okay, we drop Champagne as a label of the Swiss Champagne wine in return for Swiss Air getting landing rights in many of the European countries. In which it didn't, I mean, this is before the Swiss Air went bankrupt, right? So so the interesting thing is, what you see is basically the, in the name of national interest, and Swiss Air becomes the national interest, the state selectively chooses to protect the interests of some and sacrifice the interests of others. And then if you look, who are the groups, who are the vulnerable groups whose interests are sacrificed, and which are the powerful groups whose interests are protected, then you can see some of the tactics and strategies of the state, which will, in its rhetoric, claim we are only applying WTO rules. Had to drop it because of that. And then you see in what quid pro quo it got dropped.
Thank you. Je vous propose de l'applaudir une dernière fois.